Hey, everybody, I'm Charlie Yao, and I'm an alcoholic. And I am not from here. There's been a few people say, you're not from here, are you? And that's very true. I'm sure not. But I need to say this one thing, because this is not my forte whatsoever. But I've been in AA long enough to know that this is what you're supposed to do. So I would like to thank the committee. You know, I might be the only time I ever get to say that, so I want to thank the committee. And I've said this before, and probably a lot of, I don't even know if it came from the West Coast, but it's a story about this old boy that they invited him to speak up in Wyoming, up in cowboy country. And he got up there, and after about 90 minutes, man, he's pouring out his experience slop and dope on all this stuff. He looks back there in the back, and here's these two long, tall cowboys had these 45 hog legs strapped through their legs, and they're walking up the aisle. And he looked over there at the chairperson, and the chairperson said, "Oh, son, don't worry about that part. They ain't after you." He said, "Phew, boy." He said, "They're after that SOB that invited you." So I don't know if Mr. Glenn needs to watch his back for a little while or not, but everyone's been so nice. The flight was great. We got here about noon today, and back home, it's a basket that they gave me, but golly, it looks like about a number 3 wash tub, and it's got everything under the sun in it, man. I can't get all that. I feel like I'm shoplifting in a 7-Eleven. I get all kinds of stuff stuck in my pockets. But it is so nice. They feed me like fattening hogs, man, and just it's wonderful. And I'm the kind of guy that I do not believe in 90 and 90. I do not believe in 30 and 30. The guys that I have a privilege to work with, I'd never tell them, you know, you go when you want to or you go when you need to. Ain't but one time you need to come to an AA meeting, and that's when they're having one. And just so happens y'all have one around the clock, so you're going to see this old cowboy around here a whole lot, because I love Alcoholics Anonymous. I love it more than anything in the world. And but I hate this disease, and I know I'm not supposed to hate stuff, but maybe in a few minutes you'll understand why. It's hard for me to find gratitude for my actions. Now, I know there's steps that you take, and I have taken these steps, and I've tried to allow these steps to work in my life tonight and today and yesterday and hopefully tomorrow, and things are a little bit better, but other than that, I just love Alcoholics Anonymous. And I never get behind one of these things without recognizing the people that keep me here on a daily basis. And one of them is my sponsor. His name is David Schaffner. He has 18 years of continuous sobriety. And last Sunday, he was elected Area 16, that's the state of Georgia, the state delegate. And I love that man. My service sponsor is his beautiful wife, Lucille. She keeps doing what she's doing. January 1, she'll be 17 years sober in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. My grand sponsor is Butch DeLose. Butch Otis. He's a past DCM, and August 14th, I went over to his home group, the Garden City group, and he picked up a 24-year chip, continued sobriety. My great-grand sponsor is John DeLoach. He's 27 years sober. He's right now the Area 16 state chairman. He's past delegate and just the salt of the earth, man. If you don't like Mr. John, you push baby ducks in the creek now. I'm telling you, he's just, he is a fine man. So I come from good stock. I want to just, in about 45 minutes, y'all going to wonder what in the world happened to him, man. But it sure isn't their fault. They have not given up on me. And I guess I'm kind of ashamed to say I've given up on me in sobriety. For the corners I've backed myself into and things I've done, and it gets where you just, what's the use, man? Just, you know, just what's the use? But they bring me back where I belong, so I'm saying this where I hope there's a Charlie out there, because I'm sitting around, I'm in a room full of heavy hitters. I guarantee you, California is, we all know how great AA is out here. I don't have to say that. And the people that's in this auditorium has carried the message to people like me for a long, long time. But I hope there is a Charlie out there. And I hope there's a Charlie out there that's like me that can't quit drinking. Because that's what's wrong with me. I just can't quit drinking. Doesn't mean I don't want to. I really do want to. But I can't quit. And in December of 1993, I'm sitting in this 6x9 cell, and I get that revelation. I understand that I cannot quit. And that's exactly what's wrong with me. Now, I tried to quit. You know, I drink at the most inopportune times, man. I just, like at work or church or operating a motor vehicle, or I drank when it was absolutely not necessary to drink. Guy asked me one time, he said, "Dadgum, Charlie, you drunk again?" I said, "No, still." It was like a spiritual awakening. If you could come to on a Sunday morning, man, there's about that much left in the bottom of that jug. It was just wonderful. And what really hurt, I guess, is because I drank when I didn't want to drink. I drank when I did not want to drink. And people started putting conditions on my drinking. I don't know if anybody's ever had any conditions put on theirs, but they'd say, "You know, Charlie, you're a gifted craftsman, man. I mean, you're just meticulous in every detail. We want to show off our product. We give you an assignment to do." Because I was a union iron worker, and I was a welder, and I was certified in 12 states. I could weld anything but the crack of dawn and a broken heart, man. I know something about that. But they'd say, "Charlie, dadgum, man, it's 7 o'clock in the morning. You just reek of alcohol. You can't come to work drinking like that. Man, you get hurt on this job, it'll lock us down. And that dadgum pint of scope you just drank out there in the parking lot ain't hiding nothing, you know. So you can't, don't come to work drinking anymore, Charlie. Don't come." Now, I've been doing public work since I was 15 years old, and I can honestly stand up here and say I have never been fired from a job. Now, I have been laid off while they're hiring, though. There's people who used to just feed their families, just follow me around. Because I get good jobs. I get real good jobs. And I'd walk out the gate, and guys walking in. I'd have them a layoff. Now they're hiring. Oh, well. You know? Or people say, "You know, Charlie, you're a good friend of mine, and I consider you a good friend, but and we're having a little get-together this weekend, but don't come to my house drinking anymore, Charlie. Just don't come. Your jokes ain't funny anymore. Your intimidation doesn't intimidate anyone anymore. And you peed my azalea bush for the last time, man. I'm tired of you looking cross-eyed at my wife. And I don't even want you playing my dog, to tell you the truth. Don't come to my house drinking anymore, Charlie. Just don't come." Then the one that'll really get your attention, that says, "Just don't come home drinking anymore, Charlie. Just don't come home. You know, I made my bed. I guess I got to lay in it. But I am sick and tired of telling that 6-year-old boy who's looking at me and said, "Mama, how come my daddy don't love me no more? How come my daddy won't play with me, Mama? Joey's daddy plays with him. I'll be good. How come you and daddy fuss all the time, Mama? How come daddy works all the time? I gotta go to bed before he gets home, and he's gone before I get up. And when I see him," he says, "this weekend, partner, it's just me and you. Just me and you. Whatever you want to do, it's just going to be me and you. But it's Saturday morning and he's gone, or he hasn't even come home. Just don't come home drinking anymore, Charlie. Just don't come home." Well, you know, I got a little bit of walking around since. So I saw the handwriting on the wall and I just quit. Okay, I quit. About a month later, I quit again. About 2 weeks after that, I quit for good. About a week after that, I quit. So help me God, I quit. And it's December 1993, and I'm in this 6x9 cell, and I realize I can't quit. But there in Georgia, around the holidays, they get ready for the Christmas crowd. And I had a real good lawyer and a bucket full of money. So he took my bucket and we got ourselves reined and all of a sudden they cut me loose. Now I ain't free, but I'm loose. And there's a big difference in being free and being loose. And I go to my house and house is the appropriate word because I have drank the home away. There was three people who lived there, and there was mail that was delivered there, but all it was a house. And I go in this bedroom, and I lock this door, and ain't nobody coming in, and I ain't coming out. And what I do, probably a lot of us have done, and it doesn't make for real good telling in mixed company. And I'll put it this way. Procter & Gamble has yet to invent a toothpaste that'll get browning gun oil out of your mouth. Now that's happened almost 12 years ago, and I can still taste it every time I say it. And I'm probably not the only one in here that hadn't went that route. But I walk out the next morning, my wife's standing at the kitchen counter, and she said, "I didn't expect to see you." I said, "Well, I didn't really expect to be here, to tell you the truth. But we got to do something. I don't take me to Georgia Regional. That's a state facility we have there in town. Or take me back to Chatham County." I said, I don't want a drink, Jeanette, but I got to go get a drink right now. I'm about to die." And I didn't seem to upset her a whole lot. And I'm pretty serious about this stuff, but it just didn't seem to bother her. And she reached underneath the counter and she set a book up on the bar there. And I looked at it and I said, "What's that?" She said, "Well, that's a book." I said, "I know that's a book, but it says Alcoholics Anonymous on it." And she said, "Yeah, I've had it a couple of years." And I said, "Well, I ain't never seen that book." She said, "I know." I said, "Well, where was it?" And she said, "In the bill drawer." Well, I didn't even know we had a bill drawer, to tell you the truth. But I opened this book up, and it's got this little inscription on the cover of it, on the jacket. And it says, "The words in this book will bring you peace. The words in this book will save his life. When he's ready, I'll be there. May God bless you and keep you till then." David Shaffner, April 1992. Now, I don't know David Shaffner. I don't know Alcoholics Anonymous. And I don't know a whole lot about God blessing people. But I know something's got to be done with Charlie Boyd. I know that. She says, "You know, if you can hang on, we're going to go see somebody here in about a couple hours." I said, "We are." She said, "Yeah, yeah, I've called. We're going to go see somebody." Well, I don't know what's going on, but I hang on, man. We're sitting in front of this building. We walk in, sit down in this little room. All of a sudden, in walks this guy with the clipboard. He sits down. And he says, "I'm the assessor." And I said, "The assessor?" He said, "Yeah, I'm here to assess you." Well, I don't really know what my net worth is. But I figured, you know, kind of like giving a dying man an enema, it can't hurt, you know. So let's just get on with the assessing here. And he says, "Mr. Yow, do you come from a broken home?" I said, "Yes, sir." He said, "Well, tell me about that." I said, "I don't want to talk about it." He said, No, you misunderstand. We need to talk about these things." I said, "I don't want to talk about it." So he makes this little note on his clipboard. He says, "I see by your age," he said, do you have any military service?" And I said, "Yes, sir." "What branch service you in?" "United States Marine Corps." "What years?" 1966, 1972. "Do you see any combat?" "Yes, sir." "Tell me about that." I said, "I don't want to talk about it." He said, we're just not getting, we need to talk about it." I said, "I don't want to talk about it. I'm not going to talk about it." Well, he makes this a little note again. He says, "Well, tell me about your family life." And I said, "Well, I guess we got our ups and downs. I guess a bug flew in her mouth or something. And she got the gagging and the coughing and the carrying on. I figured we might have to do the Heimlich on her or something, you know." He gets her a drink of water, and he don't ask me to talk about that. He just makes another little note. And he says, "Mr. Yow, do you drink?" I said, "Yes, sir." "How much you drink?" "Well, I'll drink a six-pack now, man." He said, "Now that sounds like a lie." I said, "That is a lie." I said, "Mister, I drink all I can hold all the time. There's got to be one condition and one condition only in my drinking. I got to be at least semi-conscious. Other than that, I drink all I can drink and all I can hold all the time." He compiles his little notes and he looks at my wife and says, "Well, I think we'll just keep him." She says, "Good." She gives me a little peck and they just buzz her right on out the door. And they don't buzz me out the door. And they take me in this room, man. They strip you everything but your Fruit of the Looms, you know. And you spend, and they give you this dress to put on. I mean, you can tie it in the front or tie it in the back. It don't make no difference. You're going to be embarrassed, you know. And then they hand you these Unifoot slippers. They don't have any bend in them. You can wear them on your right foot or left foot, either one. Unifoot slippers. And I don't know what it is about these places, but man, you hang meat in there. And they said, "Are you all right?" And I said, "Well, I'm kind of cold." And they hand me this fishnet thing. I mean, it's like one of these things your grandmother crocheted, you know? I mean, it's 12-count shrimp go right through them holes. Now I'm standing here in this dress and these Unifoot slippers and this fishnet, and I'm thinking, boy, this ain't what you had envisioned. And I come from a long line of visionaries. Now, I mean, my Uncle Buck was a great visionary. And he always dragged a six-foot piece of log chain around with him. And they'd say, "Buck, what in the world are you doing dragging that log chain around with you?" He'd just grin and say, "You can't push a log chain." So But to be a good visionary, it's got to be the right ambiance, man. I mean, everything's got to be just right. I mean, I can have two-hour, two-sided conversations, and I'm the only one in the truck. But you got to have the right place. So where I found was there where I lived there in Savannah, Georgia, was the oldest cemetery there called Bonaventure. And before the looters got in there, you could drive in there anytime you want to. And I'd drive in the back of Bonaventure Cemetery, and I'd have whatever I was going to have right there. And I'd turn my country music on real low. Got to be low, low, see. And I'd sit there in that truck, and I'd visionary. Now, the strange insanity of that is, if I'd got out of my truck and stood on my toolbox, I could see the roof of my house. Now, Savannah, Georgia's got a real temperature differential. I mean, summertime, it can be 120 degrees with the heat index. And the wintertime, it can be 20 below with the wind chill. And I'm out here in this truck visionary. Now, I got central air and heat. I got a $2,000 bedroom suit. And I'm out in this truck. And the neighbors could see me. And they asked my wife, what in the world is Charlie doing out there at 2 or 3 o'clock in the morning down there at the cemetery? Two or three times a week. What in the world can he be doing? She'd just shake her head and say, oh, he's visionary again. But I didn't have this stuff visionary. And they take me into this room, and it's just got a little bed in it and a little restroom. That's all it's got. All of a sudden, the door opens, in walks Rosie Greer. I mean, this dude's about 6'5", about 340 pounds. He's got a straight-back chair in one hand and a Sports Illustrated magazine in the other hand. Sits that straight-back chair over there in the corner and sits down and says, how are you? I said, well, I guess I'm all right. He said, I'm the observer. I said, the observer? He said, yeah, I'm here to observe you. I said, are you going to sit there all night? He said, I sure am. He said, aren't you going to get in that bed? And I said, I sure am. So all night long, Rosie reads Sports Illustrated, and I observe Rosie. Well, they come by and they feed you in these styrofoam plates and plastic spoons, and a couple of days they send you up to the third floor for medical examination. And walked this doctor. He was an Indian doctor, not a Cherokee or Apache, an Indian doctor. Well, not there's anything wrong with it whatsoever. But with his broken English, he's trying to tell me what he's getting ready to do. And with my broken English, I'm trying to understand what the procedure is about to be. And he washes his hands real good. And he reaches over and gets one of them one-fingered latex gloves and a jar of petroleum jelly and turns around and grins. And I said, now, Doc, I don't know what's wrong with me, but where are you getting ready to hunt? It ain't there. We just can't do that. And I got this dress cinched up, and he said, it's part of the procedure. And I said, well, it ain't part of this procedure. He said, well, you'll just have to go get observed some more. And I said, I ain't got no problem with it. You can go assess me some more, but we ain't going there. Well, he makes a note, and all of a sudden, I'm making all this, but after about a week, I'm making great progress, man, great progress. And they put me out in general population. And I'm walking around my unifoot slippers and my dress and my fishnet trying to find myself. And they say, well, today you go to group. I said, group? Yeah, you go to group. Well, they don't give you a manual in this place, and I don't know what group is. But I'm sitting in this room. All these people sitting around in there. In walks this guy. Don't know what he is till he tells me. And he's the counselor. Now, I don't know what a counselor is until he tells you. And they deal with issues. Well, it's hard for me to come up with an issue right now. I'm in a dress. And he's going around asking these people, and this one guy, his third time he's been in there this year for failing his drug test at work. And he thinks they're just picking on him. And that counselor says, that's a real issue right there. Another lady, she's in there because of had to get her meds adjusted because the pool man don't show up when he's supposed to. And that clock on her Volvo just won't stay right. That's a real issue. We need to deal with that. He gets me, and I still ain't come up with no issue. And he says, well, just why are you here? I said, I can't quit drinking. And it was just like that. It was a hush just come over the room. And I heard Tom Brady say it once, because I guess you learn it in counselor school. Had to be, because this counselor did it too. He said, no. He said, now it is true you have a biochemical genetic disorder affecting the hypothalamic information control center in your brain. It seems when you ingest ethyl hydroxide, it forms acetaldehyde, which combines with dopamine, producing tetrahydroisoquinoline, and you lose control. I said, no, sir, I can't quit drinking. Well, I ain't even ready for group. So I'm back out in the day room again. And over here on this wall, in this day room, they got this little bar. It's got a sliding glass window on it. And all the guys that's in the fishnets and the dresses and the unifoot slippers were lined up against the wall at the bar. Well, I ain't the sharpest pin in the cushion, but I figured that's where I ought to go. So I'm right over there in line. And you stay orderly. You're just elbow to anal canal, and you just move right on along. Little nurse sets this Easter basket up there, and it's got all these jelly beans in it. Every kind man think of. Well, she gets to me. She looks at my chart. She says, I see you've been assessed. And I said, yes, ma'am. I see you've been observed. And I said, yes, ma'am, more than once. I see that you refuse medical treatment. And I said, well, we don't really have to go there, but... She said, well, you can have two of these, one of these. So I took two of them, one of them, gave me a little shot of orange juice, washed it down with. I said, well, what do I do now? She said, you go back to group. I said, they just kicked me out of group. She said, honey, they won't kick you out now. So I'm back in group. Not only, it couldn't have been that long, but it seemed like an eternity, man. But all of a sudden, somebody found a thermostat in that place. And boy, the temperature started rising. Off come the fishnet. I done got my dress hiked up. And I get the second revelation I ever had. My feet don't work. And I'm thinking, maybe I got my unifoot slippers on wrong. And I can get down to get them off, and I can't get up. In walks the counselor. Won't talk about issues. I got one now, Bubba. My daggone feet don't work. He didn't think that was an issue. They're working when I came in here. And they ain't working now. Well, we'll do this a while. All of a sudden, I'm standing at the bar one day, and the little lady says, you can't have none of them, one of them. So I got none of them, one of them. Gave me a little shot of orange juice to wash it down with. I go back to group. Counselor wants to talk about issues. And I said, I may have one. What's that? I said, you know, if I could get me a pint of that wild turkey, I wouldn't need them four pills you just took away from me. because that's the only thing I found that removed the obsession for me to drink. The only thing. Now, it makes your feet not work, but it'll remove the obsession to drink. Well, all of a sudden I'm in the big doctor's office. And I don't know. I mean, those people help people every day. I mean, they're angels of mercy. But it was just what I had in my mind. Mr. Clancy talks about the disease of perception. It's just what I had. Nobody would listen to me. I'm telling you, I can't quit drinking, and nobody will just hear me. And I'm telling this, he's saying, you're a sad case. I don't know. I don't know what we can do for you. Besides that, the insurance will run out. But you won't get honest. We ask you to talk about your mother. You end up talking about our mother. You want to get that stuff out of you about that war, and you just clam up. And I'm thinking, what do you want to hear, man? What is it? You want to know what's a 20-month-old baby? What in the world can you do wrong to make your mama leave? What in the world can a 20-month-old kid do to make your mama leave? And every time your daddy get in that jug, he'd say, boy, don't you ever give your heart to a woman. Don't you ever give your heart to a woman, Charlie. Because they'll just rip it out and they'll leave you flopping like a fish out of water. You understand? And I'd say, yes, sir, I understand. But I didn't understand. Because my mother wrote me Christmas cards and birthday cards all every year. And they all said the same thing. I love you, Charlie. I'm your mother, and don't you ever doubt that I don't love you. And I'm sorry things didn't work out, but don't ever forget, I love you. And when you're 15 years old and you're back in this corner, you're just like any other animal. You can't get beat no more. And you'll either fight or run away. I couldn't fight him, so I ran away. And I'm on that Greyhound bus, and I'm thinking when I get there, it's going to be all right. I'm proving him wrong today. I'm going to prove you wrong today. And I got this picket fence and this beautiful house with the farmer's porch on it, and I'm going to knock on that door, and she's going to come to the door holding some homemade cookies, and it's going to be all right. And all of a sudden, the cab driver says, this is it. And I walk through that knee-high grass, and I step up on those brick old blocks, and I hit that aluminum storm door. It's got the bottom screen about halfway kicked out. Anybody ever seen one of them? And I step back off those brick old blocks, and she comes to the door, and she's holding something, but it ain't a platter of homemade cookies. And somebody in the back's hollering, who is it? Get them out of here. And the first words out of her mouth is, what are you doing here? And I'm saying, I want to come live with you, Mother. I don't want to live with him no more. I don't want to get beat no more. I don't want to hate no more. I just want to come live with you. She steps off those brick old blocks and says, Charlie, I'm your mother. I love you. I'll always love you. But you can't stay here. You just can't stay here. You getting all this down, Doctor? I mean, is this what you need to hear? And I'm walking off. She's saying, where are you going? And I don't look back. I'm just thinking that SOB was right, man. He was right. And I carried that with me for years. But through this program, I found out how sick I was. That's sick, folks. I'm demanding that my mother love me the way I want her to love me. I'm standing in front of you today, and I'm telling you my mother loves me, period. That's what this program's given me. This program's given me a mother that loves me, period. And nothing else matters. And if you're Charlie in here, and you can relate to any of that stuff with anybody in your life, that's the sickness, that we demand that people love us the way we want to be loved, instead of giving them the right to love us. I found that out here. It was a great lesson. I said, you want to hear about this war, man? I'll tell you about this war. You got to hear the desperate sound of a three-year-old baby screaming because you just shot her mama, because her mama just handed the guy a basket full of stuff that you just shared a toothbrush with 2 hours before. And he's saying, find my arms, Charlie. Don't you let them take me out of here without my arms. You find them. And I'm saying, I'm going to find them. I'll find them. But I can't find them. And he's screaming, and the baby's screaming. And somebody else handed somebody else another basket. And I can't find their arms. And he keeps screaming. So you shoot the baby too. And you come back to the world and they call you a baby killer. But you ain't no baby killer. You just can't find his arms. That's all. You're 18 years old and you've seen enough death to last a lifetime and you just can't find his arms. Is this therapeutic? All you've done is sentence me to another year of nightmares. That's all you've done. Well, I'm wiping the snot out of my nose, and he goes and changes his drawers. He comes back, and he breaks out this prescription pad, and he says, Lord have mercy. He said, this is the highest dosage we can give, and you're going to be on this the rest of your life. I was supposed I could be a picket fence, boy. He said, and you need extensive aftercare. Really? Yeah. And oh yeah, your wife said she wasn't coming after you keys her up front. Now one thing that place did for me that I am totally, eternally grateful for is they took us to an AA meeting. Now I didn't know what an AA meeting was, but by this time I was in civilian clothes. Now I didn't have any shoelaces, but and it was voluntary. They said if you want to go and you can smoke. And I thought, well, shoot, I'm in. So they load us up on the little short yellow bus, and they haul us over here to this auditorium. And they put us way up in the nosebleed section. And I guess it's the preacher. He's up there saying a few things. And they get up, and somebody starts talking about upcoming events. And it don't take you long to realize that this is really a family-oriented deal because Susie's going to celebrate her first birthday. And they, yay, Susie. Joey's going to celebrate 3 years. Yay, Joey. And they, man, you got to give up your day job to work this. Then they stop and they start fellowshipping. And this long, tall drink of water walks up there, sticks out his hand and says, my name's David. It's good to see you. I said, how are you? He said, I know you. I said, no, I don't think I know you. He said, that's okay. I know you. I've been where you've been. I said, oh, you out on bail too? No, I ain't out on bail. He said, but we'll talk. And there was as many people there as it is in this room tonight. And he was the only one that climbed up those stairs and stuck his hand out to the guys with the big orange armbands on and no shoestrings. The only one. And I don't know why he did it. I don't guess it really matters. But he did. So I leave this place, and it's the last time I ever really thought about which way I wanted to go. Because if I turned right and went up to a stop sign and took a left, I'd be sitting right in front of a liquor store. That guy knew me better than anybody. If he saw me coming, he had it packaged by the time I got there. That guy gave me credit because I was such a good customer. That guy let me write hot checks because I was such a good customer. That guy let me forge my wife's signature on a credit card because I was such a good customer. Or if I turned left, went around a big curve, went to a red light, turned left, and the second building on the right, I could go where they're having those AA meetings. Now, I don't know why I turned left, but I did. And I walked in to this building, and there was an old man sitting over in the corner. And he looked right into the bowels of my soul. And he said, "What's your problem?" I said, "I can't quit drinking." And his old face just lit up. Just lit up. You thought he won the lottery or something. And you know what he told me? He said, "I can't quit drinking either, son. That's why I'm here. Welcome home." That old man did not tell me all these profound things that we hear in these meetings. Things like, if he didn't drink, he wouldn't get drunk. Really? Well, you just don't drink. Really? Don't matter if your hind end falls off, just throw her in the wheelbarrow and bring her right on up here. Just don't drink. Really? I don't know. I'll tell you when the first time I heard that. I was 16 years old and I was looking through a 2-inch piece of plexiglass. My grandmother's on the other side. She said, "Charlie, if you wasn't drinking that stuff and doing that stuff and running with those people, you wouldn't be in here." And I'm saying, "Yes, ma'am, I know." "Charlie, if you wasn't drinking that stuff and doing that stuff and messing with them yahoos, I wouldn't be spending my retirement trying to keep you out of the penitentiary." And I'm saying, "Yes, ma'am, I know." If there's a Charlie out here, we know. We know that we don't need to be drinking. Our track record shows it. So we don't need our intelligence questioned. I know I don't need to be drinking, but I can't quit. The book puts it real eloquently. You're powerless over alcohol, Charlie. You have lost the power of choice. And let me give you an illustration, Hoss. You're like a man that's lost his legs. You ain't never going to grow no new ones. The choice is gone. Now, I have to hear myself say that. I have to. And there's only one reason I have to say that, is just so I can continue to take the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous. Today I have a choice, or the day that I have the power. I'm not saying an 11-step program ain't a good program, But it sure ain't got nothing to do with step one. Nothing at all. Nothing. And I've been sober long enough now to know that the physical act of drinking has nothing to do with it anymore. That the bottle is but a symptom. And the liquor is just a symptom. I don't have to be drinking to be powerless over it. I know I'm powerless over it. And that old man knew it too, because he'd seen too many Charlies walk in there. Now he said, "I have found a way to space them out a little bit." And that's about the best you can do, is learn how to space them out. And that particular time, he'd spaced them out 42 years. But he talked from the heart. And he took me back in here, and they read something I didn't understand, said a prayer I didn't know the words to. Then all of a sudden they circled the wagons, and they actually talked about drinking. It wasn't so much they was talking about drinking, they was talking about the solution to the drinking problem. And I was sitting right beside a guy that spent 18 months on death row for killing the man in the blackout. And I was right there. And a lady beside me was too pretty to be an alcoholic. And she talked about how she gave her kids up and turned to prostitution to support her habit. And I was right there. And not a one of them questioned my intelligence. Not a one. And we finished that meeting. They handed me a little white chip. That was January 11th, 1994. And I've been powerless over alcohol ever since. Ever since. We got through with that meeting, and I asked Mr. Bob, what do we do now? He said, at 5:30, we're going to talk about it again. You be here. This was at noon. At 5:30, I come back. Talk about the same thing again. 6:30, I said, what do I do now, Mr. Bob? He said, 8:30, we're going to talk about it again. You be here, I'm going home. I said, yes, sir. 8:30, I come back. Guess who's sitting at the front of the row? That long, tall drink of water stuck his hand out, shook my hand. Now, I've got all this wealth of knowledge from this. I mean, $38,000 worth, something ought to be, you ought to know something. So I swander on up there to him and I say, David, I need me a temporary sponsor. Son, it looked like I slapped him in the face with a dirty mop. You know, he said, let me tell you something, Hammer, I don't do temporary. Did you come in here for some relief or did you come in here for recovery? Now, I didn't know the difference in the words, but I knew the right word to say. And I said, I came in here for recovery. And he handed me a pamphlet on questions and answers on sponsorship. And he said, you be at my house Saturday night after you read this. So I go to his house. We go upstairs. He tells me his story. I tell him about my upcoming court dates. About all I'd share. We get the book out, and we take step one, step two, and step three that night. And I'm on fire. I'm on fire, boy. And we get through, and we walk downstairs, and I said, "What? Give me an assignment, David. What you want me to do? What you want me to do, David? What you want me to do?" And he puts his hand on my shoulder, and he gave me the greatest assignment I've ever had, and the hardest. He said, Charlie boy, start being nice to people. It ain't never too early to start being nice. And that's exactly what these 12 steps of recovery is about. It takes those 12 spiritual principles for me to be nice to you. Every one of them. I've got to find that little bit of honesty. And through that honesty is some hope. And there is some faith today. And there's courage because I'm a scared little boy. And there's some integrity and willingness. And I've got to get humble. And I've got to find some brotherly love. And I've got to have some discipline. But I've always got to persevere. And I've got to be aware. And therefore, there is love and service. It takes those 12 spiritual principles for me to reconnect with you. Everyone. And when I reconnect with you, I reconnect with my God. And that's all he wants. I've been disconnected from something I should have never been disconnected from. And that's what these 12 steps have done in my life. They have let me reconnect. And I take that fearless inventory. Then I turn the page, and I'm going to tell on myself, because I see down there this next step could be postponed. So I've got my little list watered up in my back pocket, and I'm going to meetings, and I'm just hoping his schedule and my work schedule are still conflicting. This goes on about 2 weeks, maybe 3 weeks. And we got a ramp back of our clubhouse where we meet, and we're walking up that ramp one night, and he just turns around and he looked at me like that old man looked at me. He said, "You know, Charlie, it don't have to be with me, but if you don't do it, you're going to get drunk." He turned around and walked off. And I knew he knew what he was talking about. So that Saturday, I called my best drinking partner. And I'm not saying this is the way to do it at all. The book gives you, it gives you some options. But I called my best drinking partner. I called my best friend. I called my oldest son. And I said, "Scotty boy, you need to come over here. We've got to do some talking." My best friend. Y'all would love Scotty boy. He could light up a room when he walked in. But when he was 16 years old, he'd rather ride around with his daddy in the pickup truck, drink whiskey, and go to football practice. Because his old man was so cool. Well, that's cool, all right. So we got out in the backyard, and I told him what I was getting ready to do. He didn't understand. I said, "You don't really have to understand, but you just got to know that I've got to do this. Because I'm living in that maximum security prison of terror. And I'm breathing that stale, musty air of bewilderment every day, Scotty boy. And I'm sleeping on that stone-cold, hard bed of frustration. And I'm existing on those crumbs of despair. And I don't know if there's any clemency in this or not, but I got to do it." And I told him every despicable thing his daddy had ever done that I could remember. And I did not list assets, because I don't think my God needs to remove what little assets I have. So I don't think that's what that's all about. But we get through and we hug, and he cries and I'm crying. I go do step 6 and 7, he go get drunk. That summer he gets married. He lets me be his best man. And my ex-wife and husband-in-law is coming down. And guess what? They're on the list. Wherever. So after that reception, I get them out in the front yard where we've got a little working room, you know. And I'm saying, "You know, I want to take full responsibility for my actions and the heartache I put you through, Ann. And Don, I'm sorry I broke your jaw on your front porch. That just wasn't a nice thing to do. And whatever I need to do to balance these books, I'm willing to do." And she said, "Why are you doing this?" I said, "Well, I'll tell you. I'm in Alcoholics Anonymous, and this is part of steps I got to do, and I need to get my side of the street clean." She said, "Y'all got that chip system down here in Georgia?" I said, "Oh, yeah." So I pull out my little yellow medallion, 6-month chip, and I give her the whole lowdown, boy. If you want to surrender to win, and I'm just telling all this. She reaches in her purse and pulls out a 4-year medallion, man. Son, I was livid. I had to go to my sponsor about that. I said, "Man, I'm spilling my guts to this hussy, telling her how sorry I am. I've been sober 6 months. She's been sober 4 years. She ain't never said a word to me." And he gives you that sponsor talk. Golly, I hate that. Puts his hand on my shoulder and says, "Well, Charlie boy, looks like you didn't make the list." Well, now there's a moral of that story. I am standing here in front of you with a 11-year chip in my hand right here. God willing, about 90 days, it'll be 12. And she ain't eligible for what? Because I can hear her. She's sitting in them meetings and say, well, you just don't drink. You just don't drink. No matter what, you just don't drink. And you pound your fist against the bar and say, what in the world happened? Where been all my high resolve? That's why we take these steps for those Charlies that's sitting out there. That's why we take them. A lot of things has happened in this walk of mine in sobriety. December 2002, that best drinking partner of mine, I get that phone call, and if you're a parent, your guts just kind of knot up because it's 2:30 in the morning. And this happened. Scotty's flipped a Jeep Cherokee 8 times, and he's dead. All I can say is, okay, okay. And I called David, and it takes a good 25 minutes for me to get to my house, to his house, on a good day. 15 minutes, he's knocking on my front door. Now, this is why I always recognize the people that keep me here on a daily basis. And he walks in, and I'm saying, David, I don't know what to do. Scotty's dead. And I don't know what to do. Do you know what he tells me? Nothing. And Lucy walks in and holds my wife and lets her cry like a baby for 3.5 hours because I can't even touch her. And you know what she told her? Nothing. The next morning, my grand sponsors called me and said, Charlie, I'll take you to North Carolina, and we'll stay up there as long as we have to. You don't have to go through this alone. Did he tell me what to do? He didn't say nothing. They were there. And that's what true sponsorship is, in my opinion. Now, I've heard guys say you got to have two qualifications to be a sponsor. You got to be at least one step in front of them. And under any and no and all conditions, never agree to go out drinking with them. And I think that's a good policy. But my sponsor's a step guider. And that's what he does. And I went up there and I went to her house and I walked in. She had one of them Easter baskets sitting on the kitchen counter. She said, you're going to need some of these. I said, yeah, I know. But no. She said, you're going to need them, Charlie. And I said, I know I am. But I need God more. Because my God does not come in pill, powdered, or liquid form. He just doesn't. So I'm standing in front of that casket. And at that time, I put that 8-year chip in his hand. And I said, just take a little bit of this with you. Take a little bit of my sobriety, Scotty boy. Because a whole lot of me died the day you died. A whole lot of me died the day you died. Untreated alcoholism. Untreated alcoholism. He just couldn't quit. He just couldn't quit. I love this program. And if there's a Charlie out there tonight, welcome home if you can't quit. It's okay. It's really okay if you can't quit. But if you'll let us help you work on a little bit of honesty, you may just find that defense. Because I have. When you're in when you're from Tennessee, you write a bunch of stuff. And it took me, I wrote about half of it, and then after Scotty died, I finished it. And it ain't good or nothing like that, but it just kind of sums up exactly what I'm supposed to do behind this podium when I talk about what I used to be like and what happened and what I'm like now. See, it was late and dark one dreary night, and he was riding in the rain, this young, restless outlaw that was aching with pain. And he slumped over his saddle seat, and he looked toward the sky and said, "God, I just wish I'd die." And he was searching for a place to lay his weary head, and he unmounted his mount, and he unrolled his bed. And he was looking through the blackened sky, and he was searching through his mind, and he thought of all the broken hearts that he had left behind. "Yeah, young, restless outlaw, you're living too fast. Think you better slow down. It's not going to last. Because, you see, I've been through it all myself. But now that's all in the past. For the outlaw's reign is over. His trail's come to an end. You see, he's the kind of man that dies without a friend. Never has that starry night. And he never has that home. You see, the life of the outlaw's life. It's the same as my own. But times they are changing. And this outlaw has been reborn. No longer fear and hate and resentment is his crown of thorns. It's love and peace and faith in the sunshine and the rain. For this old and wore out outlaw has finally stopped the pain." God bless Alcoholics Anonymous. God bless.
We hope you have enjoyed this recording. To obtain additional copies, receive a free catalog of AA and Al-Anon talks, or to find out about our tape and CD of the month club, call Encore Audio Archives at 1-800-878-1308 or visit our website at www.12steptapes.com.